Support for the Commodity Week podcast comes from Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign with crop insurance, grain marketing, and commodity brokerage services. Details at sfarmmarketing.com. And by ADM, their FarmerView mobile site features up-to-date futures, weather, market commentary, and local bids, and offers customers access to contracts, deliveries, and payments at adm.com/farmerview.
The following program was recorded the 28th day of June.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Later in this half hour, we'll talk about the markets and the USDA's grain stocks and acreage reports with Joel Carlin of Western Milling in California. Our panelists in studio today include Dale Durkles of AgriVisor LLC out of Bloomington, Illinois, Chuck Shelby from Risk Management Commodities out of Lafayette, Indiana, and Aaron Curtis from Midco in Bloomington, Illinois.
Support for Commodity Week comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333. And by ADM, their FarmerView mobile site features up-to-date futures, weather, market commentary, and local bids, and offers ADM customers access to contracts, deliveries, and payments. Available at ADM.com/FarmerView.
Well, let's get our program started with this question, Chuck Shelby. This morning, on Friday morning, the United States Department of Agriculture released the acreage report. It shows producers planted 97.4, or will eventually plant 97.4 million acres of corn. The harvested number, just a little lower than expected, though, at 89.1. What was your reaction?
Well, I think the reaction of myself and our company in the trade was a little surprised by that. But we dug into those numbers, Todd, and when we dug into them, where did those increases come from after the March intentions? Other than Nebraska, the states that really increased were all the peripheral states, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, all those different kind of states out there, not really your Corn Belt states. So it might be a little bit interesting in the long run to see what kind of yield comes out of states like that.
Dale Durkles?
Well, you know, when you... Everybody was really shocked by the numbers this morning because they came out, frankly, as big as they did. People were generally had been talking about, you know, 1.5 million. There were some people that said 3 million down on corn planting. So I think everybody was really surprised. The 89.1 number for the harvested really is right in line. And, you know, when you step back from the fray and look at it, we can still produce a good crop if Mother Nature holds up. And right now it looks like she's going to.
And Aaron Curtis.
Well, it would have been interesting to see what would happen if the weather would have cooperated this spring, because if you come in at 97.4, up 100,000 acres from the March number, and we did have some obviously some issues in the Corn Belt, and like Chuck said, the Corn Belt areas for the most part were unchanged to a little bit lower, and you know, he talked about those outside the normal corn acres continuing to see some increase this year as some of those areas kind of got on the corn planting bandwagon a little bit. So, yeah, the numbers were surprising, but I agree with Dale. I think it's still weather from this point out, and, you know, what the planted acres or harvested acres number is going to pale in comparison somewhat to what that final yield number is.
Dale, this actually was a really big planted acreage number, the largest since 1936, and we planted about 102 million acres back then.
Yeah, it really was. You know, a lot of people, you know, when they started looking at the combination, and I think it was not just the corn number, it was the soybean number that went along with it that really caught people's attention. But, you know, when you look at corn, and we had that skip of good weather there a couple of different times in the month of May when we really planted a lot of the acres and put them all in the ground, you know, it looks like producers just want added. And when you step back and you look at the economics of corn versus beans, you know, everything had always been saying, you know, go plant corn. And it looks like, you know, hey, they went and they planted corn seriously.
They planted corn seriously, Chuck, but they may not have planted corn as seriously as many people had thought. If you look at the state breakdown year over year, in the state of Illinois, 600,000 fewer acres. Iowa, 200,000 fewer acres. Indiana, down 150. Minnesota, down 50,000. The only place in the top five that gained any were Nebraska, up 200,000 acres.
And I think that goes back to the weather, the struggles of getting this crop in. Farmers in southern Wisconsin, parts of Iowa, parts of Illinois are struggling with excessive rainfall. We got the crop in, but it was a struggle. I think that the other component of this, it better keep raining because a lot of this crop went in under wet conditions. I know we drug planters through fields, and that's great if it keeps raining, but if it dries up, you're in trouble.
You know, the other thing you have to think about in the broad mix on here, we had a little, somewhere around 2 million acres that came out of the CRP program this year, and, you know, that all mostly was in peripheral-type states, so that may be part and parcel to why that's where some of the increase was, too.
All right. The corn numbers look like this on the week. July contract, the $6.85 and a half top, bottom at $6.50 and a half. It posted an outside up week, technically, at $6.79 and a quarter in the lead option or old crop July, up 17 and a half cents. December futures, on the other hand, at $5.11, were down 45 and a quarter. What does this divergence tell you about the market for old and new crop?
Well, kind of what we've been talking about really for the most part of the spring, the fact that the balance sheet continues to remain tight historically for the old crop, and the chances of building somewhat burdensome supplies or even the some very bearish supplies here as we move forward. And I continue to see that divergence in the spreads. We saw the July SEP and the July July DEIS make a considerable run here again late this week. Also the same with the July August and the July NOVE on the bean side. So that continues to highlight those two, the differences between the two balance sheets here as we move forward. And I think we're going to continue to see some of that movement here as we move forward. Deliveries once again versus the July contract on corn and soybeans were nil. I would expect that to continue. Very light on wheat also. So we're going to continue to see some of that play and those bull spreads continue to circulate here as we move into next week.
USDA will in July, of course, as it does every month, release the world agricultural supply and demand estimates. It will update what the ending stocks are for this marketing year and for the next marketing year. And we can talk about the grain stocks number in just a bit, but let's look forward to the next marketing year at this time. New crop, what do you think that number will look like?
I would venture a guess it's probably still somewhere up in the 1.7, 1.8 billion bushel range. You know, it's you're still looking with a 155 bushel yield, you know, a crop that's going to be up there getting close to 14 billion bushels. So, you know, it's still going to be a pretty hefty number they're going to start out with.
In our mindset, it's a little bit lower than that. Maybe 1.5 is what we're looking at, 1.4.
And Aaron, do you have a number?
Yeah, probably a little bit in that 1.8, 1.85 number. I don't think we're going to see much change in the July report, obviously, to yield. I think they'll see it still be somewhat conservative, especially if crop ratings continue to increase a little bit. So I'd look for a rather large number once again.
That is a big spread from one to the other, and it could make, but still, it they're all fairly large numbers, and does that mean the $5, even if we're down at the 1.514, that the $5.11 is as, you know, as much as we're going to get out of this crop?
Well, I think it comes back to transition, Todd. You got a huge disparity between the 2012 crop and the 2013 crop. How is the market going to deal with that? There's obviously, I think, going to be some early premium. How do farmers react to that? Do they rush in and sell that crop? We got plenty of storage space out there in the country right now. So it's going to be interesting to see how those two numbers merge as we get into or closer to harvest.
Hey, is he right? Is it about how the bins fill up and where the grain just sets and stays?
What do you mean by the bin fills up?
Well, he's suggesting that farmers might look at it and say, it's so low, I'm not going to bother selling it at this point.
You know, they may want to choose that, but see, the other flip side, you got to look at it as far as the end user himself. You know, and the end user at this point with the acreage number here today, and whether you look at corn or beans, either one, was basically throwing a carrot and said, you know, I really don't have any reason to really rush in here and buy anything, especially given the weather forecast we're dealing here with for the next couple of weeks yet. So I think the burden really is put on the people that still own the old crop bushels, not the people that need to buy it.
Aaron, your view?
Yeah, I think the processor is going to find a way here at the end. I think we saw that last year, and of course some of that was driven by the southern harvest being so early, but we've continued to find a way, at least in central Illinois, to keep the processor from paying any outlandish basis numbers here, and I think that's going to continue somewhat. We've seen CIF values on corn and river values kind of level off here a little bit, and would expect that to continue a little bit, especially as the corn export program remains on the stagnant side. So, you know, if these southern progress continues to move along, I think we'll find a way to get some of that corn up here once again and maybe kind of bridge that gap here as we move on.
You know, I was told by a merchandiser today that he remembers back in the summer of 96 when corn supplies were so tight, and one morning he went to work and they were paying $1.10 over the board for corn at that day, and by the time they got to noon, they were at 70 over. That's how fast it can go away.
Let's take a look at the stocks numbers as they came in from USDA on Friday morning. On the corn for the stocks number, 2.76 billion left in the bin as of June the 1st, and soybeans at 435 million. Was there anything that seemed strange in that number to you?
It was a reduction. I think it pointed out the tightening of the supplies. I think that's a number, you know, when we look forward to next year, we carry in a smaller number. And will the usage continue, or will we kind of feather off as we move into, you know, the third quarter here?
Daryl Good told us on our shows Friday and in my studios Friday morning that maybe WASDE's July might drop down another 100 million bushels to 650. That would be pipeline. Beans he didn't think would move because it's already at 125.
Well, that's the problem with the market again. Do we really have what we say? And how tight is it, and how do we transition? I think that's a key.
You know, but there comes a point, and the thing that gets lost on everybody out there, and yeah, I know people want to talk about logistics, but we aren't short of anything in the world, and I think people have a hard time realizing or understanding the significance. The other thing, as far as corn is concerned, I thought the wheat stocks number was interesting because it implied we were feeding more wheat in that last quarter of the wheat marketing year than people had thought. Now, on balance, that says we're planting or we're feeding both a lot of wheat and corn. But if you note where we ended up Friday, Kansas City July wheat ended up below where Chicago July corn ended up. And we're having wheat yields out in the southern plains that are coming in really a little better than people thought they were going to. And I think you really have opened up the pipeline here for the rest of the summer. Feed wheat.
Is he right? Is it feed wheat? USDA made that note last summer, but I'm not sure that anybody was convinced that that happened.
Yeah, I think that's a tough one to get a hold of, obviously, and we've continued to struggle with that over the last couple of years, how much exactly feed wheat is replacing corn. But I think Dale's right. I think with yields being better than expected so far in wheat, I think that could move into the balance sheet a little bit. I'm not predicting a 100 million bushel decrease in ending stocks in a couple weeks on the old crop, probably closer to 25 to 50. And I think Daryl's right. I think bean ending stocks are about as low as we're going to see them on paper.
Wheat this week, by the way, a high of 695, a low at 646 and three quarters. Settlement price there down 49 and a half cents at $6.48 and a half. And the soybeans on the week, July contract at $15.74 and a half for its top on the week, the low at 1485 and a half. The lead option, like the corn, posted an outside up week, settled at $15.64 and a half, 71 and a quarter cents higher. November beans at $12.52. We're down 21 and a half. Is there reason to think that soybeans need or should or can go lower still?
Old crop or new crop?
New crop.
New crop, yeah, I think you probably got a little bit of downside in here, but I don't think you got the kind of downside risk you do necessarily yet in that you do in the corn market. But I could see the November itself, you know, maybe in the short term losing another 40, 50 cents.
I think when you look at the acreage in southern Illinois, Indiana, the double crop acres that are going to be included in the regular acres, and I think the USDA has got a pretty lofty number at 44 type bean yield with kind of weather pattern we've been in, wet conditions. Beans don't like to be planted wet. They don't like to be in wet feet. So I think there's some room for the bean yield to come down, and that impacts the price.
Well, I still think we got some downside risk still in beans. I still expect ending stocks to continue to grow next year, and I guess I'm somewhat positive still on what we could see on bean yields and maybe even see the bean acres grow here before we're all said and done. We'll see what the resurvey says, but I think any type of bounces in new crop beans need to continue to be sold.
Now, there was one of the things USDA did say, we're going to come back and count bean acres again, but they're not going to do it with corn. Do you think they should have?
I don't know the accuracy. Over time when they do those surveys, you know, we don't really, in the end results, a lot of times nothing's really changed. So I guess we're good with the corn number now. I could see, you know, there's a lot of beans yet to go, and it's pretty difficult, again, to get the correct answer.
You know, when they took the survey for this report the first 2 weeks in June, we actually were far enough along in corn planting at that point in time that, you know, you really start to question, you know, can I justify the expense of doing much of any resurveying for corn versus beans, where we still had a fair amount to get in the ground, even down here in the heart of the Midwest. So, you know, I think it was just looking at cost benefit, and, you know, they probably just didn't see it in the corn. And I don't know that it's really all that necessary.
You're listening, of course, to Commodity Week. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. You can find us online at willag.org. That's willag.org. Our panelists in studio include the voice you just heard, Dale Durkles of AgriVisor out of LLC in Bloomington, Illinois. And Chuck Shelby is with us from Risk Management Commodities out of Lafayette, Indiana. And Aaron Curtis of Midco. He, too, is from Bloomington, Illinois. A couple minutes, we'll be back. We'll talk with Joe Carlin of Western Milling. He's from Goshen, California.
This is Jim Angel, state climatologist located at the Illinois State Water Survey at the Prairie Research Institute on the campus of the University of Illinois. Rain was fairly widespread across the state this week. Some of the heavier amounts of 4 to 6 inches were in the northern and southeastern part of the state. Heavy rains fell in northeast Iowa and southern Wisconsin as well, causing moderate to major flooding along the upper Mississippi River and its tributaries. Temperatures were on the warm side and 3.3 degrees above average. Humidity levels were higher as well. Since May 1, growing degree days with a base of 50 degrees have been very close to average. They range from 840 degree days in northern Illinois to 1,050 in southern Illinois. Considering the lack of days over 95 degrees, the temperatures have been very kind in the last 2 months. According to the National Weather Service, things will cool off for the next 2 weeks. Highs on Saturday are expected to be in the mid-70s across the state. Lows for Saturday night are expected to be near 60 degrees. Highs on Sunday will be in the mid-70s. Lows for Sunday night will be in the upper 50s and low 60s. Highs on Monday are expected to be in the mid-70s with lows around 60 degrees. It's the same story for Tuesday and Wednesday with highs in the mid to upper 70s and lows in the upper 50s and low 60s. This is Jim Angel, state climatologist at the Illinois State Water Survey.
Support for Commodity Week comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of 5 hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333. And by ADM, their FarmerView mobile site features up-to-date futures, weather, market commentary, and local bids, and offers ADM customers access to contracts, deliveries, and payments. Available at ADM.com/FarmerView.
This is the June 28 edition of Commodity Week. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. In studio with us, Chuck Shelby, Dale Durkles, and Aaron Curtis. On the phone line is Joel Carlin. He is from Western Milling out of Goshen, California. Joel, thank you for being back on the show. I think this is your second appearance, but it's been a while. Can you remind folks who you are and who the company is that you work for?
Sure. This is Joel Carlin, and I'm the merchandiser, a market analyst here at Western Milling, which is one of the largest feed mill in the on the West Coast. And we have facilities here in Goshen, which is right in the middle of the San Joaquin Valley, and down in Ontario in the Chino area, and also in the Phoenix area. And we service many of the dairy cows. California, the largest dairy producing state, and we service the cows essentially from the whole state, from Chico up to Chino and moving west. And we also do quite a bit of feed business overseas and with a number of the large hog and poultry operations here in the state.
And where would you normally source inputs, corn and soybeans, from?
We source a little local corn, but most of our corn comes from the Western Corn Belt, South Dakota, Nebraska, western Iowa, and Kansas.
Okay, this is the reason I wanted to talk to you. So what does it look like from your point of view, that vantage in California, when you try to reach into the Corn Belt to bring supplies to the West Coast?
Well, in addition to the the escalation of commodity prices over the past few years, many of our customers have been saddled with extraordinarily high rail freight rates. Let's say 7 years ago, it may have been $30 to $40 per ton to bring a car of corn out here, and now it's closer to $90 a ton. You have a lot more competition for bulk commodities. You only have two main rail lines, the UP and the BN, and we're at the end of the earth. So we've really, end users here have been really hurt in that regard.
When you look forward to the upcoming crop, and it's obviously going to be bigger than last year, how's that going to impact your bottom line and being able to buy corn cheaper than last year? How's that going to impact your business?
Well, I think it'll be, favorable. We're obviously looking for quite a bit lower futures prices, and, basis levels have been record high throughout the country, particularly in the Western Corn Belt that was really hurt by the drought last year, and we're looking for some sort of, relief there. Our spot corn prices right now, recently to the dairies, has been about anywheres from, $300 to $320 per ton, and some of our customers are hoping to, to procure corn maybe this fall around the $200 to $220 per ton level.
Joel, when you look at this huge premium we have for the old crop over what we're working with on the new crop even today, as an ingredient buyer, how do you manage the situation that you're confronting now as far as your buying program would be concerned?
Well, I mean, really, you really want to go hand to mouth. I mean, nobody wants to be paying, as I said, this inverse. We're looking at a, at least a $70 inverse between old and new crop. Many of our customers have been really hurt financially, so they're not willing to extend, and so they've been going hand to mouth, and they also realize how the board is shaping up, and they're just hoping to eke by until we get into the fall and the prospect of, more ample supplies and hopefully far lower prices.
Joel, piggybacking on that, how concerned then are you with old crop supplies here as we move to the second half of the summer?
I think we're somewhat concerned, for distiller uses. We use a lot of distillers out here. Protein mills have been very expensive, and distillers grain on a per-unit of protein basis is quite a bit cheaper. And we've heard from some of our Western distiller suppliers, they're very leery about contracting corn, and they're not going to, not sure whether they're going to run or not. So actually, while we have ample supplies for July, it's been fairly difficult to get offers, for instance, with distillers for August and September.
You mentioned that you do export feed ingredients. Have you been able to be competitive on the world market at this point?
Yes, somewhat competitive on the world market. Keep in mind there's a lot of boats coming over here and not a whole lot coming back. But, Jay, we do some business in the Far East, so freight is relatively reasonable. I know that we have a lot of Chinese contacts, and our prices, not only for bulk grains like corn and milo, but for a number of the byproducts, are very cheap, and we're also doing a bang-up business in shipping alfalfa to China. Alfalfa supplies here in the valley are very tight. On the other hand, it's a competition between Chinese buyers and domestic dairy customers, and then the Chinese seem to have the wherewithal and the funds to procure these very tight supplies.
If we look ahead and presume we have a good crop that will develop, and the price goes down, where do you see the demand increasing on a lower price when they're used to paying a very high price for corn and meal and those kind of inputs?
Well, I think what you're seeing is, I think you'll see some increased supply. I mean, I think that you've had a lot of, and particularly cotton and dairy producers, the dominant end user out here, because of high concentrate prices and low milk prices, they really try to phase back the feed costs. So they've been using a lot, the amount of forage used in the ration has increased at the expense of concentrates. With relatively high hay prices, I think that you'll see a little switch. Some of our corn customers that, we are currently feeding, let's say, 7-8 pounds a day. If corn prices get really cheap, let's say $200 a ton, for some reason Dease corn does move down to close to $4 a bushel, you might see that to increase to about maybe 12 to 15 pounds. And similarly, I think you'll see an upward increase in the inclusion of protein meals also. I think our customers, primarily dairy producers, are salivating at the prospect of upping their concentrate inclusion and increasing their milk production.
You know, Joel, I know you've done a lot of work in the past and looking ahead at crops and stuff, and it is a little early in the season, but what kind of yield numbers are you generally putting around the corn and the bean crops at this point?
Dale, I'm fairly optimistic. I mean, I think the USDA's bean number 44.5 is fairly, that's fairly optimistic, maybe close to 43.5, but I have a corn number of like 160. I know the USDA is 156.5. In their new weather-adjusted yield model, they did phase that back because, May 15th plantings were about 20% less than expected. But, I've been of the opinion that I think that the heavy, in many cases, record spring rains that occurred in much of the Midwest months from now will be seen as a blessing as opposed to a curse because subsoil moisture levels were incredibly low. And I think that, yes, there are certain areas, obviously, in northern Iowa and southern Minnesota into western Wisconsin that, unfortunately, we're not able to get the crop in the ground, but there are many other places that improved. And if you take a look at this drought monitor map, you can marvel. It's really almost been miraculous where most of the Corn Belt now is out of the drought. Unfortunately, it's pushed to my area of the country.
Joel, with the exception of the corn acres numbers, anything else in today's reports that stuck out to you?
No, as I said, not really. I mean, I think that, it was mentioned that both the wheat and the corn stock numbers were a little lower than expected, perhaps implying, a little higher, feed usage. I think that the, even though the acreage number was a little higher than expected, the USDA, perhaps in a nod to the wet weather, did lower the harvested planted ratio from 92% to 91.5%. I mean, my feeling about the report is I think they're going to be forgotten fairly quickly. I think that, right now I think the market is going to focus on, weather and, the outside markets. But, a couple of things that I'm thinking about, longer term is, and a couple of bearish factors, particularly for corn, is number one, last year, in addition to the U.S. suffering drought, all other major grain-producing countries of the world had adverse weather. This year, you look at Russia, you look at China, you look at the European Union, you look at India, they're all enjoying favorable weather. The second consideration is, and we're not talking about it now, but increasingly, I think there'll be some talk, even with lower corn prices, how the USDA demand number seems rather optimistic. So, a combo of maybe a little better production, perhaps the market sentiment is that yields are on their way up, and a more sober assessment of next year's demand, you could be looking at corn stocks, well in excess of $2 billion, and perhaps these futures, maybe 3 months from now trading, perhaps as much as a buck lower. At least that's our customers' hope.
Hey, Joel, one final question. You mentioned that feed usage for corn might be upped by a third to 45%, depending on which number you're using. How much of that you think extends across the livestock industry?
Well, this is somewhat interesting. I can more buy into better domestic demand for soybean meal, because I think that the meal-intensive industries, the swine industry and the poultry, are doing certainly better than the more corn-intensive ruminant sector. Both dairy and beef are really having a lot of problems, which is why, I question the USDA's big jump in feed usage next year.
Thank you so much, Joel.
You're more than welcome.
Joel Carlin is with Western Milling. A very short final word from our panelist, Chuck Shelby.
It's coming into the month of July, and weather is going to be the driving factor.
Dale Durkles?
We're probably going to have a little bit more pressure here in the short term, but we are running into a window for a short-term low in corn.
And Aaron Curtis.
I continue to watch the old crop contracts here. I think you've still got old crop supplies. Continue to look to be rewarding the market and getting those moved.
That wraps up this June 28 edition of Commodity Week. I'm Todd Gleason. Okay, stay put, if you will. Joel, do you have time to stick with us?
I sure do.
Oh, excellent. So on my question, you mentioned that the dairy cattle are probably going to eat a whole lot more corn. And so I was thinking about that and what that meant for the livestock industry in general. And then what it might or might not mean for the feed and residual usage number and why it keeps moving around so much. And that maybe USDA just can't get a handle on it because there's a much larger variation in how much grain's actually being fed to these animals than many had expected. For instance, I would never have thought that corn usage in a dairy cow would be down by 30%.
It is, but as I said, you've got to keep in mind, when you feed corn, that's energy, and as I said, as far as energy, that makes more milk, and you just, when you do your marginal analysis, right now, it may pay, but, for a lot of these guys, they haven't had the money to feed corn. Many of our customers, and they don't look at, the net energy, the crude protein. They're just looking at the bottom line price, and they just don't have the funds to pay. Anything that has if it's in the 200s, is certainly better than paying in the 300s. It's also very difficult, even though per cow consumption of corn may increase, because of the lack of a full milk production report, we really don't have a good handle on what the cow inventory is out here. Cull rate's been about 4 to 5% ahead of year ago levels. It's starting to slow, but I think what you're going to see is less cows, and maybe those cows that are in the hands of more profitable operators starting to increase their intake.
And another question that came to my mind as you were talking about what the feed ratios and rations were, what did the alfalfa grown in California displace?
Well, it really hasn't, displaced much. To be truthful, the amount of alfalfa grown in California has actually been going down, as is the amount of wheat and corn silage, because of two issues. Number one, we just don't have the water. If you have water, increasingly it's going to go to the perennial crops, like the almonds, like the pistachios, and increasingly walnuts. Less is going to, hay and silage. And the other consideration is that if you grow a crop, is there anybody around with the money to pay for it?
Other than the Chinese, because they have been a huge buyer of alfalfa products coming out of the West Coast in particular to their dairies.
Dale, that is going to continue. That is a really big factor. I mean, if you California producers, they're still going to be hurting because let's say they do have lower concentrate prices this year. They're still going to be paying out the nose for forage.
I assume this is pelletized before, but it still seems like it's awfully heavy.
No, not all of it is pelletized. I mean, they'll bale it and ship it in big containers.
Oh, that sounds like it'd be heavy and hard to ship, man. I can't imagine it's cheaper to get it from the U.S. than to grow it.
They would. The key is that China is rapidly moving from backyard feeding of their dairies into more modern 21st century rations with nutritionists and farm managers. And I think one of the things I think about is how soon it will be where China starts importing more feed grain and most of their corn goes to silage, because they're really realizing the importance of high quality silage in terms of rumen performance and milk production.
Joel, I was driving through eastern Washington last weekend, the state, and I noticed that obviously they have a lot of hay stacked up and it's all tarped up and keep it somewhat dry, I assume. But I noticed one place had some shipping containers at its place. Could I assume that that's being loaded with hay and shipped overseas?
Yeah, I could. I mean, most of the hay, I think, is going out of Long Beach, but I think if some of that hay is working down the river to Portland, it's being exported out of there. I think South Korea and Japan, but and they source a lot of hay from Australia, but also China. I mean, those Far East markets are, are definitely snapping up. Hey, we got the hay buyers are all over the West Coast. So I think that, unless it's, I assume that it's working its way to, export channels out west.
Another thing, this is Dale, looking at the numbers we had today, and, it kind of mirrors back in March to a degree, but are you a little surprised that we didn't see any more increase in hay acreage this year?
Well, I think you did. I mean, you had some bad weather early in the year, but I mean, it just, I tell you, Dale, except for the PNW, the water situation out here is critical.
Right.
And as I said, at the beginning of the year, we had some wet weather put down some hay, and then, you know, I can't imagine with this heat coming in this weekend, your fourth and fifth cutting is going to be anything worthwhile. I mean, top quality, you know, 25% protein, 56 TDN hay is going to be very, very short supply. A lot of this hay, you know, is probably not going to be any better than dry cow hay.
Mm. When you look ahead here, you seem to be like a lot of end users kind of holding off and that everything's going to be okay. But what would be a trigger point to make you feel uncomfortable as far as the weather going here in the Corn Belt? What would be an uncomfortable weather that might make you change your opinion? You might need to do some covering.
Well, I mean, the forecast going out the next 10 days look very favorable, and I think that trumped anything that the USDA put out today. On the other hand, you know, we have some fairly impressive heat here, and, you know, is it possible this high-pressure ridge could eventually, you know, work their way in into the Midwest? I mean, you know, right now, as I said, for the first half of July, it looks very favorable. Most years, you'd probably see a limit down move, but the fact is, because this year's crop is so late, it's really going to be the second half of July that's most important. And what happens if the high-pressure ridge suddenly, you know, pushes off to the east and starts moving into the Midwest around July 15th? And as somebody referenced earlier, you have a lot of corn with short feet. You shut off the spigot for 2 weeks, and that could be a disaster.
Can I turn that one and ask the panelists in studio, maybe we'll start with you, Aaron, what would be your trigger if you were looking to this that would cause you to think differently about the marketplace than you do today?
I probably have to be something, some continued dry weather forecast. I think a couple weeks of dry weather obviously is what we need right now. I mean, most producers would take that in a heartbeat, I think, for the most part. I know, like Chuck mentioned, we're going to need some sort of regular rain, especially on some of this stuff that went in a little wetter. But for the most part, I think we'd have to see some sort of continued dry weather. And I don't know how reactive the market would get at this point. And, you know, maybe if we saw some sort of reversal in the Dease corn, new crop corn, maybe we could build on that a little bit. But I think more than just a couple weeks of dry weather, it's probably going to take in order to get too excited.
You know, it's going to be the weather that really is the Trump factor as we go forward, no doubt about it. And because it is late, like Joel said, you know, you're really looking to something more to the latter part of July for the corn in particular, to really guide, you know, what you think about going ahead. Beans, we have to look on to the month of August. You go back to 1984, we planted crops late like we did this year. We ended up with a corn crop that was good. Yields were a little above trend, but we ended up with a bean crop that ended up with yields a little below trend because the very end of summer that year, last half August and early September, actually got kind of warm and dry. So, you know, it is going to be a weather market going forward. That's really going to be the dominant influence. And, you know, the other thing, and none of us can talk about, is what are some of these economic things around the world going to do? You know, that's a wild card we all deal with.
Well, we compressed a lot of corn planting into 1 week, made tremendous progress. So it really makes it critical to have a good 2 weeks of pollinating and fill weather on this crop. That can happen, but at one point here we're hoping that the rain stop, but to anticipate that they're going to turn back on at an ideal time with the volatility of the weather we have, we're not predicting that can happen. We're just saying, as a marketer, there are factors that can turn this market, and we've seen it. We saw a week where corn jumped 45 cents in just a few days on ideas that the weather may turn dry in July. So it makes it difficult to take a position, whether you're a producer or end user, and feel very comfortable with that position for very long.
Which 2 weeks is critical here? Is that week 3 and 4 of July or week 4 and 5 of July? Because there is a fifth week in July.
I think it's probably pushing back to the fourth and fifth week. The corn's making pretty good progress, but it can take a little stress. Drying out, as we've talked, would be good. Mm-hmm. But, again, the timing of the rain, you better have a kind of a good two-week window with some consistent rains out there.
July 4th is usually a day when folks think the market might change directions. Maybe not the case this year?
Well, I hope Dale's right. We're making a kind of a seasonal.
Well, the problem is the 20-week cycle in corn extends actually all the way into the end of the month of July here. You know, it's window. But, you know, we are in a point in here where it can bottom at any point. The question is when. But even if it does bottom, how much bounce do we get? That's the other thing people have got to recognize at this point. So we could get a forecast, you know, start to dry out. We get a little bit of a bounce. We don't get much of a bounce out of it. Let's say we go down to 5 and we come back to 5.25. I think either side of that fourth week in July, you know, by a few days, you know, if there's nothing wrong there, you know, the corn market, people are going to start putting a crop in the bin and you're done.
Fourth week of July starts on the 22nd, the last day of July. That's a Monday, the 22nd, that is. The last day of July is Wednesday, the 31st. Any wisdom from the West Coast on when the market might or could turn?
Well, you know, I usually the maps after the 4th of July are the most important of the season. I've been saying for a while that perhaps the maps after Labor Day might be the most important of the season because you know, this crop's going to be laid, and you know, growing degree day accumulation is very slow. And without question, most of the corn belt, particularly in the area that got planted latest, is going to need a frost-free September. So I don't think the market's going to be able to, even if things look very good and pollination goes well, I don't think the market's going to be able to give up the ghost completely until we get, you know, probably through the middle of September, I would imagine.
Thank you all for staying.